This nation was founded on the principle that all men are created equal.
We hold these truths to be self-evident.
That all men are created equal.
I'll tell you what freedom is to me. No fear. I mean, really, no fear.
Created equal.
From WDET in Detroit, this is Created Equal. I'm Stephen Henderson, and I'm in the studio with the show's producer, Kerry Jr. II.
It's the Friday recap.
We need a Friday recap song. That might be it. That we might can record be... you singing.
No, geez. We could just come up with our own little jingle that we do, and then I have like an ad lib.
I like that idea. We need to talk with the engineers and the technical staff here and Sam Bobian about writing a nice jingle for the Friday recap.
I think that should be it. I think we just go Friday recap. There we go. See, we got it.
Do it in harmony.
Okay, we got to get to the topic.
Yeah, we got to get to the show. Yeah. So the recap this week has two really great shows in it. One was a look at debt and debt relief with Richard Vague, who is the author of a book called The Paradox of Debt. We also talked with two reporters from the Reveal podcast about pregnant mothers in Gaza and how they are unable to get adequate health care, and how one mother had to actually try to leave the country during the war to get the kind of help she needed.
Yeah, there's a lot we could say about that, but I'll save that for when we get to that segment. Yeah. Since we're going to start with Vague, I'll start there and just kind of say that we came to that one because locally there are efforts to forgive medical debt in our region. In Wayne County and Oakland County, they're looking to forgive thousands, millions of dollars of medical debt and help thousands of residents, 300,000 residents in Wayne County and about 80,000 residents in Oakland County. So they're working with a program that's going to help, like, I think it's they're going to try and buy that debt for pennies on the dollar.
Yes.
We spoke to Vague broadly about kind of debt and how it works in our economy. He says it's necessary. And also, he thinks that waiving debt is kind of the solution to how we deal with it.
Yeah, I mean, he talks about how the burdens of unwanted debt or unmanaged debt really keep people from opportunity and the growth of their own kind of personal economies, and that wiping it out for them gives them a chance to just kind of reset. And that's not just good for them, but that's good for the economy itself. It really moves everything forward when you do it. So let's get to Richard Vague and his conversation about debt. I'd like to talk about things like medical debt, which is not a voluntary debt in most cases, right? It's not something people go out and seek. It's something they have to have because something has happened to them, right? They need a medical procedure, or they're staying in a hospital and they can't afford it. Let's talk about that kind of debt and whether relief, just taking it away from folks, is the right way that government should be thinking about it.
Yeah, this is a real problem / opportunity. I think that, you know, the United States, different from most other major developed countries, does not have broad government support for healthcare. And so you have folks facing medical emergencies where their insurance doesn't properly cover it, or they have a surprise medical bill. And that's one of the biggest contributors to hardship and bankruptcy that we have among households in the United States. If we had a better, more comprehensive medical insurance coverage, we wouldn't see a lot of this. So for that very reason, I'm very much in favor of anything we can do to provide relief on the medical debt side. In the situations you're talking about, the individual has already been struggling with it. The institution that made them extended them the credit, which might be the hospital itself, by the way, has already written that loan off. And so that debt is already trading at 1 or 2 cents on the dollar. And you know, it's sometimes sold to collection agencies for 1 or 2 cents on the dollar. And if they can get 3 cents on the dollar when they collect, they make a profit. And you know, it ends up in a raft of phone calls and heartache and struggles and the like. So we see some organizations going in and buying off that debt for a 1 or 2 cents on the dollar and canceling it to give relief to those debt holders. I mean, to those individuals.
Yeah,
I love that and am fully in favor of it.
So I want to talk though about this type of debt more broadly. As you point out, it's almost true that no one who issues this debt really expects to collect it anyway, right? A hospital that is, you know, providing you care for, say, 30 days and the bill is hundreds of thousands of dollars, but you don't have money to pay that. Of course, the hospital has to say, well, you owe us this money. Let's set up a way for you to, you know, to pay it over time, and we'll issue debt and you know, charge you some interest. But that hospital knows they're never going to get that money. And as you point out, they're just going to write it off, right? They get some relief from the fact that the individual can't pay. But the individual is carrying that debt, and that has an impact on everything in their lives, right? It has an impact on their ability to issue other debt. What if they got to buy a house? What if they got to buy a car? What if they have to send a kid to college and want to borrow money? It seems like this is not real debt so much as it is burden, right? It's different from other kinds of debt, and it is something that holds people either back from economic advance or pushes them back into economic trouble. Why do we do it that way? When in the end, as you point out, no one's going to get their money in full, but the damage done to the person who is the quote borrower can in some cases be permanent.
Well, you know, this is a particularly problematic area because it's, as you've suggested, you know, it's not somebody who planned to buy a car and bought it, you know, or, you know, planned to do some other thing and borrowed to do that. And that loan's got, you know, their lives have taken a turn and they're unable to pay it. This is an unexpected expense.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, a lot of times with the healthcare plans being somewhat complicated, it's what we call an out-of-network expense.
Right.
You used a doctor or had to use a doctor that's not covered under your plan. So instead of getting a $1,000 bill, you get a $50,000 bill or something like that. Well, the average family can't even begin to hope to pay that. Now, the majority of bills a hospital sends out, you know, are not like that, and they get paid. And,
yes.
And people, you know, people act in good faith. I mean, that's one of the wonderful things about this life that we live, is that people try and they act in good faith. So most of that debt does get paid, but there's a small percentage, typically, you know, call it a low single digit percentage, mm-hmm. that the individuals simply don't have the capacity to pay, and the hospital doesn't have the capacity to extend the terms sufficiently. And that's where all the heartache lies. And that's, you know, that's a place we should seek to fix. And we could fix it, you know, on the front end by having better health care coverage. And we could fix it on the back end by having more lenient solutions to this. But the truth is, it's exactly as you suggest. This actually ruins a lot of folks' lives, and not just over the short term.
Yeah. So are there examples that we might think of around the world of countries that handle this better? I mean, certainly there are countries that socialize medicine, or at least the cost of medicine and access to medicine, in a way that eliminates these bills. But in a society that is structured economically the way ours is, and is a, you know, is a capitalist economy, is there a better way to think about these things than in the sort of classic borrower lender context? Again, this seems not like other forms of debt, and I'm wondering why we treat it that way.
Yeah, I mean, it's as I go and discuss household debt with colleagues in other countries around the world, they're always a little, you know, surprised at the problems we have in this area because they simply don't have them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm talking the United Kingdom and Germany and France and places like that, Japan and others, where they simply have a better system from the standpoint of paying for these kind of things. So we're kind of, as far as the developed country is concerned, we're kind of on our own in that regard. And, you know, there are ways, I think, that we, you know, one of the ideas, one of the smartest guys I know in the healthcare space thinks that the first step we should take that he views and I have studied and I view as a pretty easy step would be to extend Medicare down to folks that are at the age of 50 or 55.
Right.
That, you know, that's where a lot of these problems are. Young people tend to be a lot healthier, and a lot of these problems are, it's already a well-established and well-trusted system. And if you did that for folks that took advantage of that, this problem would go away.
Hmm. That proposal to extend Medicare down to 55 or 50 was part of the original Affordable Care Act proposal that the Obama administration put out. And there was this incredibly spirited debate. Spirited is probably a very generous word in Washington, in Congress, about that proposal. And ultimately, it was not part of the Affordable Care Act. I mean, it got excised, and in fact, Joe Lieberman, who had been a Democratic vice presidential candidate, was one of the people who led the charge against it, and felt like that was going too far. But the word that people use, of course, when they criticized that idea was socialism. This was too far into socialist economy, according to so many people, and that, you know, that word, of course, has tremendous political power in our culture. But I wonder what you make of that balance between something like that, which would eliminate debt in a capitalist system that would allow for better wealth generation and wealth preservation, and the fear that somehow you're overregulating an economy in a way that veers into, you know, this dirty word of socialism.
Yeah, it's a shame, but you're exactly right. That has become, you know, a lightning rod. It's become, you know, a word that folks run away from. But truth is that, you know, we there are socialistic elements to our economy that work quite well. You know, we have roads and airports and any number of other things that, you know, we kind of couldn't do any other way. And if you look back in American history, you know, that was true from the very founding of our country, that we used government money to jumpstart, our version of the Industrial Revolution. The railroad revolution that happened could not have happened without substantial government support in the early period. You know, that's true of our federal highway system. The American history is replete with instances of the government intervening in a way that's highly beneficial to society. And so I don't think we have to be ashamed of that. And I think anybody who thinks of a past where the government didn't do that sort of thing is engaging in a world that never existed. Mm-hmm, you know, so mm-hmm. They just forgot to read their history book. And so I don't think we have to run away with it. And, you know, Medicare is a battle-tested, time-honored, and in fact, loved service. And so just incrementally extending that by some small amount, you know, shouldn't be that controversial. Of course, we're at a point in Washington, D.C., where very little, if anything, is going to get done. But I think we ought to keep it there, ready to go if that changes.
Yeah. I mean, I think the difficulty is getting people to see that something like the proposal to extend Medicare downward, you know, to 55-year-olds or 50-year-olds is actually something that helps everybody. That it's not just about the people who would pick up insurance.
If employers thought about this, this would take a big burden off employers and their insurance expenses. You know, this increases, this reduces absenteeism. This, you know, the societal benefits of this are profound. And, you know, any business, you know, and I know lots of business leaders who would be in favor of this. Mm-hmm. And they see the considerable increase in their own healthcare coverage expenses for their own employees. And this would bring some element of relief to that. So I think that, you know, thoughtful leaders on both sides of the aisle, if they just rolled up their sleeves, would see the benefit of this.
Yeah. Back to the subject of wiping out medical debt, what would happen if, you know, every county in America decided to, you know, substantially wipe out or entirely wipe out medical debt? Would that push us forward, or would that cause other problems in the economy that we ought to be wary of?
Well, to revisit that subject, that debt's already largely been written down.
Right, that's right.
The adverse economic consequence of that debt has already happened. And the price to buy this off at, you know, pennies on, you know, at a 1 or 2 cents on the dollar is de minimis. I mean, it's a very low price tag. And, you know, to save millions of families from hours of anguish, I can't see any downside to this.
Yeah. That was Richard Vague, the author of The Paradox of Debt, telling us about how debt holds people back, but also how we can relieve debt for folks and not just push them forward, but push the economy forward.
It's also interesting. I thought it was interesting that he identified the difference between like individual debt for folks and then kind of broadly
macro debt.
And how that works in our economy and how it's necessary. Because when I first heard that he thought that debt was necessary, I was like, wait a minute, whoa. But then, you know, after hearing.
Yeah, it's necessary for everybody. I mean, if you're buying a house or a car, you got to have debt. But if you're going on a vacation, it's not a great idea to go into debt to pay for it, right?
And I guess we don't think about it that way. We just think debt bad.
Yeah, right. No, it's not always bad, but you got to manage it and you got to have a way out. Okay, we're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we're going to hear from two reporters who told the story of a pregnant mother in Gaza who needed relief while the war was raging. We'll be right back with more Created Equal.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.
Welcome back. I'm Stephen Henderson, joined by Carrie Jr. II, and you're listening to Created Equal. So next, we are going to hear a bit of a conversation we had with two reporters for the Reveal podcast who wanted to explore what the healthcare system looks like in Gaza during the war, and especially what it's like for pregnant mothers.
Yes. Reporters Gabrielle Burbet and Salman Ahad Khan, they spent some months talking to a mother. Her name is Lubna Reyes. She was 42. She was a high-risk pregnant woman. She was pregnant at the time of the attacks in Gaza, and so she had to navigate a healthcare system that was kind of crumbling underneath the attacks. And those conditions made her pregnancy, like many other women in Gaza, way more complicated.
Yeah. It's estimated that there's some 5,000 women who are trying to get healthcare while they're pregnant in Gaza right now. And in this clip that we're going to hear, Gabrielle and Salman at one point actually lost contact with Lubna and connected with her sister, Wafa Reyes, who evacuated to Canada. We're going to hear about how they explain how complicated the evacuation process can be for these 5,000 women. So, guys, Wafaa was able to leave Gaza for Canada because she had Canadian citizenship. What did that mean for Lubna, her sister, who was pregnant?
So when Wafaa left Gaza, she could not take Lubna with her. So she was trying to do everything she can to pressure the Canadian government, along with the thousands of other Gazan Canadians, asking the Canadian government to get their family members out of Gaza. By the end of December, Canada had announced an evacuation program that they would launch. Mm-hmm. And they said that they would evacuate the family members of Canadian citizens out of Gaza. So that seemed, in that moment, like maybe Lubna would be able to get out before her due date. Yeah. At that point, she was going to be due in a couple of weeks. But the problem right away was that the program very quickly came with all of these red tape, all of this red tape. Mm-hmm. First, the program would not even launch until January 9th. You know, that was over about 20 days away at that point, and it was going to be past Lubna's due date. And Wafaa didn't even know if Lubna would be alive then. And then the program also had a list of requirements that Palestinians, that Gazans would have to provide in order to apply. So they would have to provide documentation like biometric data, a record of all of the passports they've held, every scar they have on their body, employment history since the age of 16, which was just a completely unrealistic bar for so many Gazans to meet because so many of them had evacuated their homes with just a few minutes warning, in Lubna's case, in the middle of the night. So right away, this program had all of this red tape.
Yeah.
And Wafaa, when we spoke with her, was not optimistic that Lubna was going to be able to get out through this program. And she was right. So, you know, it's now April, but we reached out to the Canadian government for comment at the end of March for the status of the program. And by the end of March, this is over three months after the program launched, they had not been able to evacuate anyone out of Gaza, despite the fact that they had launched this program. So they had 986 applications, and no one had been able to get out of Gaza through that program.
Wow.
So the Canadian government cited problems with local officials, but it's just been a complete failure of an evacuation program.
I think it's,
go ahead, Salman.
It was also jarring for us to see the differences in the way that the Canadian government had treated Palestinian Canadians versus the way they had treated Ukrainians. A lot of family members began pointing out that when the war in Ukraine started, Ukrainians didn't even have to be related to Canadian citizens to qualify. There was no cap on how many people could apply, and Ukrainians coming to Canada were even offered financial support. And so Palestinians in Canada were often asking, why can't we have the same thing for our families that the Ukrainians got? I think it was just a very jarring experience for us to see the disparity in the way the two groups of refugees were
treated. I want to talk about that disparity and why it exists and what can be done to sort of loosen that up. What is the reason that Palestinian refugees are treated differently from people from other countries?
So when we asked the Canadian government about these disparities, they cited, they said that all of the programs are run differently and it's so dependent on the conflict on the ground. And that was as much as they said. You know, when it came to things like, you know, they did provide an answer to why Ukrainians were offered financial support. They said that Ukrainians were offered financial support because they didn't have to be related to Canadian citizens to apply. So presumably Palestinians coming to Canada had family in Canada that could help them. But that was like the only point where I was like, okay, I guess that's an answer. That's a direct answer to one of our questions.
Right.
But otherwise it was just citing different situations on the ground, that the conflict was just more difficult to navigate. But I think what's worth noting is that it was something that they said they were going to do, but then they didn't do even at all. I mean, like, we're talking about a discrepancy in what, you know, in these program requirements, but it's like, at the end of the day, it doesn't even matter because no one's been able to actually get out through the program at all anyway. Yeah. So, yeah.
And I think that's also the point that was really infuriating a lot of the Palestinians that we were talking to, mm-hmm. was their tax dollars had funded Ukrainians coming in who weren't even related. And then the Canadian government's explanation was, because Palestinians have family members in Canada, they will not get the support from the government that the Ukrainians got.
Right.
And despite all of that, they still did not evacuate the people. And I think the other important thing to note is that this was like one of the, especially when we were talking to Wafa through this process, mm-hmm. this was also one of the few moments where Palestinians in Canada were given a bit of hope that they could actually get their family members out in time. I think the Canadian government was one of the first Western governments to launch a program like this. And that was, like, we were talking to other sources as well, and that was a moment of hope for a lot of them.
Yeah.
And just to see that hope be stretched out over months and months and months, and then eventually have the same outcome, was just devastating.
Yeah.
And I think it's worth noting, I just want to make clear that, you know, the people we talk to, like Wafa and the people we talk to in Canada, are saying, of course, we should do everything we can to bring everyone who is going through crisis. So they're not saying Ukrainians shouldn't get this treatment. They're just saying, why is there not the same treatment being offered to Palestinians as well? Hmm. I think it's also worth noting that the United States has not launched any evacuation program at all. So there's a difference in how Canada and the U.S. are responding to the crisis as well.
Yeah. So Lubna does eventually evacuate to Egypt after her family's names appear on a Facebook list. We've got a quick clip.
It was maybe 10 p.m. and we opened the Facebook waiting for the list. So when we find our name, we were like screaming, shouting and hugging each other and crying. You know, because khalas, we will be out of this war, out of this death, you know.
How is she now?
She feels very lucky to be there. At the same time, when we spoke to her after her delivery, she just kept telling us that she is not okay and that they are not okay. Mm-hmm. They are in Egypt, where they are not able to work. They are all, as you know, she said, dealing with the emotional, psychological toll that being in Gaza took on them. She's trying to make sure that her two teenage daughters will be okay after this. Her eldest daughter, Tia, who's 18, she said, is having horrible nightmares every single night, has to sleep with Lubna in the bed.
Wow.
So in addition to dealing with a newborn, she's also dealing with trying to support her family through what they've been through and trying to figure out how they're going to make money. So it's a very bleak situation. They've applied for residency in in Australia and have been denied, and they are still waiting for Canada respond to their application to at least evacuate them from Egypt to Canada.
My last question is about people who are still in Gaza, mothers, pregnant mothers. If the war were to end tomorrow, I think everyone anticipates that at some point it will end, the level of devastation there is so great. I wonder what happens to them in the future. As I said, Lubna's potential future in Canada seems like a good opportunity. What happens to everybody else who will continue to need access to this kind of care?
That's a tough question. Because I think that's something that'll be hard that'll be hard to see unfold over the next few years, because someone we had talked to said that the message was very clear for them, that Gaza was not made to be an inhabitable place anymore.
Yeah.
And anybody who could leave was trying to leave. And one of the big reasons for that is that the utter destruction of the healthcare system we've talked about. I mean, I personally can't even imagine what it must be like to just see all, like basically every medical facility that you're used to. So all your cancer hospitals, your maternity wards, all we were talking to someone whose aunt was undergoing dialysis treatments, and in the first few weeks of the war, she passed away because she just wasn't able to get those treatments. Mm. And from what we understand, like, those figures are not necessarily being included in the larger figures of the toll of this of Israel's war. And I think that's something that I guess the entire international community will have to reckon with and do their best to support the rebuilding of Gaza however they can.
Can it be rebuilt? Is that even possible?
I mean, again, I think I don't think it's a question of whether it can be rebuilt or not, but whether it's allowed to be rebuilt. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of it has to do with, especially right now, as we're seeing, the U.S. government has a big role to play in this. The Israeli government has a big role to play in this.
Yes.
And I think the international community has an equally big role to play to pressure both of these governments to allow the rebuilding of Gaza. And I think, again, the thing that keeps surprising me that kept surprising me about this story was, no matter even despite this intense blockade over the past 16, 17 years, Palestinians in Gaza were able to build so much. They had fantastic universities. I think they had my understanding is they had one of the highest literacy rates around the world, just because for Gazans, education was such a high priority. For people like Lubna, education was such a high priority. And that was one of the reasons she didn't want to leave Gaza before this, was she wanted to stay in Gaza and help build a prosperous future for all of Gaza.
Wow.
And I think it's heartbreaking to see all the people who've been forced to evacuate and have basically been forcibly displaced from their homes. And a lot of them want to go back. But it's just...
Right. It's a question of go back to what, right?
And yeah, if they'll be allowed. I mean, there's a question of, you have to go across a border to get back into Gaza. Will those people be allowed to cross that border again? Mm-hmm. There's so many...
And I think there are historical parallels with the Nakba, where so many families were forcibly displaced and they thought that they would be able to go back, and they were never able to go back. And that's why Palestinians are one of the largest refugee populations around the world.
Yeah. That was Gabrielle Berbe and Salman Ahad Khan, two reporters for the Reveal podcast, who produced a story about a mother in Gaza trying to give birth while the war rages on. We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we're going to hear a conversation about non-fatal police shootings in the city of Detroit. Stay where you are. We'll be right back with more Created Equal. You're listening to Created Equal from WDET in Detroit. I'm Stephen Henderson here with the show's producer, Carrie Jr. II. So for our last segment, we are going to listen back to a conversation, a serious conversation we had about non-fatal police shootings in the city of Detroit. And what caught my eye about this was a recent story in the Detroit Free Press that took a look at these shootings from 2015 to 2021 and found that about a third of them didn't result in any criminal charges for the victim. In other words, police were chasing and ended up shooting someone, but then didn't actually accuse them of a crime or prosecute them. A really interesting statistic, not the same as we hear for fatal shootings, but just as important.
Yeah, they weren't charged or convicted of a violent crime. Yeah, 10 out of 29 people that were shot on duty by on-duty police officers, and this is from a time period of 2015 to 2021. Mm-hmm. One point you really make clearly in the show is that, you know, folks who are killed in those shootings you can't go to them to ask them what happened during that altercation, right? But these are folks who have survived the shootings, and we also see the cases play out. And so now we're looking at these violent interactions, seeing there being some harm done to citizens and wondering what happened in these cases and what were the tactics that, you know, required or where the police officer found that type of action was justified. Some other statistics from the story, there are about 125 people shot by the Detroit Police Department since 2011. That includes both fatal and non-fatal shootings. And departmental discipline was rare across the board. But all but one of these shootings was deemed in line with department policy. Two cops who were cleared were later involved in additional controversial shootings. Not necessary. And then the last thing is when the department is sued, there are some civil lawsuits. The payoffs total nearly $2.5 million. So this is costing them some money.
Yeah.
And so for this episode, we had two folks from our Board of Police Commissioners, folks who are supposed to oversee the police department, come and join us.
So we talked with Quantes Presley, who is the chair of the Board of Police Commissioners, and Daryl Woods, someone who actually served 29 years in prison before his murder conviction was overturned. He joined the Board of Police Commissioners in 2024, just in January of 2024. What do you make of the departmental discipline that gets meted out in the police department, and whether it's sufficient? Do we have a problem there?
Yeah, I think that it is a kind of complicated issue because, again, when you have Michigan State Police who investigates all officer-involved shootings of DPD suggesting that the use of force was justified, it really does tie the hands of the chief to then exact discipline if what they engaged in was suggested to have been justified. And I think that in many ways speaks to the strength of the unions, mm-hmm. That the chief recognized that through arbitration that whatever disciplinary decision he might make may be overturned, you know, by their union representation. And so, again, it makes it very difficult. But what I would suggest is the community can use a tool that I think may be underutilized, which is its Board of Police Commissioners. I did review for the names that were mentioned in the article whether or not a CCR, what we call a community complaint report, had been filed, and a complaint had not been filed in either case, mm-hmm. which suggests that the citizen didn't fill out a report letting the Board of Police Commissioners know that there was a negative encounter that they had with law enforcement that then would enable our investigators to investigate, and then providing more support, if you will, or reinforcement for the chief to be able to make a decision if it is sustained or founded that some wrongdoing had been exacted. And so when we think about the nine categories that our chief investigators investigate, force is eight of the nine.
Mm-hmm.
So we're not getting a lot of force complaints from our citizens. And again, I don't know if that's a matter of the traumatic experiences not really allowing them to avail themselves to the resource. But I do think that it can be another avenue to hold these officers accountable, because, again, outside of DPD or even Michigan State, to know that the Civilian Oversight Board also has an investigative body that can look into these incidents might also be helpful in holding these officers accountable.
Yeah, yeah. Daryl, do we have a problem with force in Detroit? Do we have a problem with accountability for force that's used in Detroit?
I think that the chief probably have a couple of bad actors on the department that he wished that he can get rid of, for sure. And I think that...
But it's not that easy to just
do. It's not that easy to do. And I would say this, that Senator Stephanie Chang have a plethora of bills in the Senate right now that will address a lot of these concerns within police departments throughout the state of Michigan. Mm-hmm. And I'm a strong advocate for the passage of those bills to give us, as well as the chief, more tools to be able to utilize to get rid of the bad actors. But I have seen a strong commitment by this chief since I've been on the Board of Police Commission. There has been cases, you can't speak publicly on different things and stuff like that, but he has brought cases to suspend without pay, and those have been sustained. And without going into any of the details of any of them, but you know, I've seen that strong commitment by the chief to do that.
Yeah.
You know, and so a lot of people don't see all of the nuances that take place in having to mete out discipline.
Yeah.
You know, it's not just a magical wand to say you did wrong, you're fired. You know, it don't work like that. You know, this is not television, but they have rights. And sometimes you probably would like to see some be disciplined more. You know, I know a particular one person on there who have cost the citizens of Detroit too much money, Mr. Q. I could say that he cost the citizens, absolutely, too much money. And thank God that he is not on the streets anymore. And I pray that we continue to be able to rid the department of folks like that, mm-hmm. you know. And so I have confidence in this chief. The Board of Police Commission have confidence in this chief. If we had no confidence in him, then we would say that.
Right, right. Again, 313-577-1019 is the number here on the phones. You can go to Twitter, hashtag Created Equal, or at WDET. Let's start today with Daniel in Detroit. Daniel, what's on your mind?
Well, I'd like to start by thanking your two guests for their service. It's a difficult time to be working in law enforcement right now, and I really appreciate everything they do. I've been on the show before when we've had these topics, and I think you know my position on this. I think every time we talk about police shootings, we should be also talking about the tipping point of these situations, and the tipping point is resisting arrest. What percentage of police shootings in America start with resisting arrest? And why aren't we talking about that every time we talk about police shootings? Because we need to get it out to the public that if you resist arrest, your chances of getting shot and killed are great. There should be a campaign at the gas stations, at the grocery stores. There should be billboards in the city that talk about this. And I don't know why we're not discussing it. Every time you have a show like this, you should talk about it. Has there been a study on police shootings in America and what percentage of these shootings start with resisting arrest? Because I would think it's in the 90 percentile.
Hmm. So Daniel, I do appreciate the call. I love that you listen to the show and call frequently. And you're right. We've had this conversation before and I am familiar with your position on it, but I think you're also familiar with mine, which I will repeat before I go back to our guests. You know, resisting arrest is not a justification for lethal force. We have the police to de-escalate situations, to make things safer for people in the city. That's their job. And when they show up and things are chaotic and near this tipping point that you're talking about, no question, tensions can run high. But their job is to ratchet it down and not ratchet it up. And so I'm not saying that in every case that's what's happened here, but certainly that's the question we ought to be asking rather than what did the citizen do to incite the police officer to what they did. The onus is on the police officer, and the reason that they're called to a scene is because emotions have run high, maybe someone's behavior is out of line. But the use of lethal force has to be reserved for the most extreme cases where life itself kind of hangs in the balance, mm-hmm. either the officer's life or somebody else who is involved in the incident. I think, you know, shifting the blame to the citizens is kind of a strange way to think of it, Daniel. I just don't understand how you kind of use that as a starting point. But I'll let our guests respond as well. Daryl, I'll start with you this time.
Excellent point. I share your sentiments on that. And this incident that happened with the gentleman with the knife situation, I believe that happened last year. Mm-hmm. Before I became a police commissioner, Teferi Brent, who was one of the community leaders in here in the city of Detroit, him and I, you know, was able to have a meeting with the chief and have a meeting with the assistant chief and the deputy mayor at that time to say, you know, let's figure out a better way to be able to address these situations in a non-lethal way. And I'm happy to say that the department heard our cry, and the chief was deeply concerned about that situation as well. And now they have what you call bubble wrap and other non-lethal things that they can utilize to be able to address those who have those type of crisis going on in our community. Yeah. And so I am a firm believer that we need to utilize every non-lethal opportunity or apparatus that we have to be able to help with the citizens, you know. So we are doing much better, mm-hmm. Even just from last year. Mm-hmm. And they have bubble wrap, they have all kinds of things now to be able to use now. And then also the assistant chief have these community summits going on right now. Yeah. They are happening throughout the city of Detroit in every precinct. So citizens who have some major complaints can come together with the officer and to be able to address those issues with the officer there in a restorative way. Yeah. And sometimes they find out that the officer could have did something different. Sometimes the citizens get some education on why the officer did what they did. And so bringing that into place, and, you know, before I came on the Board of Police Commission, I worked with Mitch Album to create a program called Better Together,
right.
As you featured earlier. But we bring police officers together. We brought them together with people who believe in defunding the police, people who were gang members and all of that, and to be able to just bring them together in a way just to have a community conversation. And those are magical moments. And so we have to be in a place where we don't turn on each other, but we turn to each other, you know. And so that's why all of these type of things are vitally important, and that the chief and his staff are listening, you know. And if folks have ideas, I think they are open to it, you know. That the police department serves the public.
Yes.
It's serve and protect, and not protect and serve. Yeah.
All right, so good conversation. I do want to make sure that we include the statement from the Detroit Police Department that Ikana Mova included in her story. She quotes them saying, "Whether or not charges are issued against a suspect in an officer-involved shooting is separate and apart from the question of whether the force used by the officer was justified."
Yeah, I mean, important statement from the police, but even more important things said by the police commissioners we had on about how they try to hold the police accountable. And they take a lot of flack sometimes, including on the show. If you go and listen to the full conversation we had, you can hear some of the calls or social comments that we got that were critical of the police commissioners. But it was clear that they are concerned about all this, and they want to be sure that, you know, force is used appropriately, mm-hmm. in the city of Detroit. And then when it's used inappropriately,
people are held to account for what they did.
And they outline some methods in which citizens can voice their concerns.
Yeah, you know, that's
they,
right.
They do acknowledge that their role is limited, but they do state out, they do explain kind of what can be done, what you can do as a citizen to participate, and how they can work with you to help make the process a little bit smoother and their accountability a little bit more representative of what the citizens want.
Yeah, yeah. So that'll do it for our weekly recap. You can go listen to the full episodes of all of these shows at our website, WDET.org. That's it for Created Equal. You can listen to recent episodes at WDET.org and make sure to subscribe to our podcast where you can leave us a rating or a review. Created Equal is produced by Carrie Jr. II and David Lines. The audio editing is by Connor Anderson and the music is by Sam Bogan. Created Equal is a production of WDET, a listener-supported service of Wayne State University.